So today I'll be talking about a paper I wrote recently with Peter Graham and Sajid Rajendran, talking about a new way to try and detect axion dark matter using cosmic microwave background polarization observables. So the outline of my talk is roughly that I'm going to briefly review motivations for axions, theoretically, and review axions as dark matter as well. I'm then going to remind you of an effect which has been known about for a very long time, where if you have a polarized light wave propagating through an axion background, it causes the linear polarization of the light to rotate. Having reminded you of that effect, I'm then going to talk about a specific polarized source that you can use, can apply this effect to, and that's the cosmic microwave background. Just briefly review why it's polarized, how it gets polarized in the first place. And then I'll basically apply this effect to the CMB to talk about the observables that are modified as a result of this axion-photon coupling. People have previously looked at this rotation effect of the CMB and have found different effects from the ones we find. And I'll explain why we're finding new effects which have not previously been examined for this particular rotation effect, and that has to do with the mass of the axion that we're talking about in this particular work. Then at the end of the talk, I'll show you, once I've done this application and show you what the observables are, I will show you experimental limits that you can already place using existing data, and also future discovery potential for this search using both current and future CMB data that will be taken in the near future. So to jump right in, we know dark matter exists. There's a wide variety of evidence for this over many cosmological scales, down from, you know, the observable size of the universe down to dwarf galactic scale structure. There's no alternative explanation that can convincingly explain all of these features other than dark matter. But its existence has only been determined gravitationally, and we have no non-gravitational detection of dark matter at this point in time. So the basic question is, you know, what is this particle? How does it couple to the standard model non-gravitationally? And that's kind of a hard question to address, because there's a very wide range of orders of magnitude and mass that dark matter could potentially be at, all the way from very light bosonic dark matter candidates, things like axions down to 10 to the negative 22 eV, all the way up to things which are a good fraction of the solar mass, primordial black holes. And there are a variety of, you know, well-motivated theoretical candidates that sort of exist in various ranges in this mass, full mass range. But we really don't know where the dark matter sits on this possible range of masses that's about 80 orders of magnitude wide. I'm going to be focusing today on these bosonic dark matter candidates, and in particular axions and ELPs down at the lightest end of the mass range. So why axions? So axions are well motivated for a variety of reasons. Firstly, they solve the strong CP problem of QCD. So we have the theta term in the Lagrangian, which we know would give rise to an unacceptably large neutron EDM, shown here. There's some combination of this theta term in the Lagrangian and phases in the quark mass matrix, which would naturally give rise to an EDM which is like 10 to the minus 16, but we observe observationally constrained to be less than 10 to the negative 25. So that means this theta bar parameter has to be less than something like 10 to the minus 10, and we need an explanation for that, because this should expect it to be order 1. Petcher and Quinn supplied a solution to this problem by just basically positing the existence of a global U1 symmetry, which is spontaneously broken at a very high scale F, a global U1A symmetry. The Navier-Goldstein boson of that breaking then couples to the GG dual term and basically turns this theta term into a dynamical field. Below the QCD confinement scale, vacuum instanton effects break that symmetry explicitly and basically create a potential for the axion, which dynamically drive this field down to the minimum of its potential, basically dynamically adjusting theta bar to be equal to zero. So this light pseudo Navier-Goldstein boson excitation of this field is known as the axion. So it's very well theoretically motivated. For the QCD axion specifically, there is, however, a relationship between masses and couplings. So once you've set the spontaneous symmetry breaking scale F, there's basically a prediction for how large the axion mass should be. And with some model dependence, there's also a prediction for how the axion should couple to other standard model particles. So for instance, one such coupling is this phi FF dual term, which can sit in the Lagrangian. And generically, once you've fixed F within some model dependence, you have a prediction for what this coupling should be. But you can also go beyond the QCD axion, just to think about axion-like particles more generally. These are light pseudoscalars which have axion-like couplings, so couplings like this in the Lagrangian, but you can just decouple the masses and couplings from each other, so they're no longer related to some fundamental symmetry breaking scale F. They're essentially just independent parameters. And these types of particles are also generically well-motivated degrees of freedom, because they exist sort of generically as low-energy excitations and effective descriptions of UV completions of the standard model, something like string theory. So for the remainder of this talk, it's these axion-like particles, or ELPs, that I'll be talking about. I'm going to be referring to them as axions throughout the talk instead of the QCD axion. Okay, so axions also form an excellent cold dark matter candidate, because they can be produced non-thermally via vacuum misalignment. And the way they behave essentially is in the classical field limit of QFT. because the occupancy numbers for the axion are enormous when you have very light masses. So for a 10th to negative 22 eV axion, you have about 10th and 94 particles per cubic de Broglie wavelength. So this is an enormous number of degrees of freedom in a single cubic de Broglie wavelength, which basically means I can describe the axion field by a classical field. So at any point in space, it's a non-relativistic classical field. So at any point in space, I can write down the axion field as a function of time, just as some oscillatory cosine, which oscillates around the minimum of its potential with some amplitude and a period equal to its mass, or very closely equal to its mass. Moreover, these axions can also behave as so-called fuzzy dark matter. So at the very lightest range of these masses, down near 10 to the negative 22 eV, it turns out the de Broglie wavelengths of these particles are astrophysically large. So a 10 to the negative 22 eV axion has a 0.5 kiloparsec de Broglie wavelength, and that essentially ends up suppressing structure on scales smaller than the de Broglie wavelength. So this may be one way to potentially address these so-called small-scale galactic structure anomalies, the too-big-to-fail missing satellites and core versus cusp problems, which are potentially tensions between in-body simulations and observations of small-scale structure. However, once you get too light in mass, you begin to be constrained by observed small-scale structure in the universe, so you can't push much below the 10 to the negative 22 eV axions. But you can at least potentially alleviate some of these tensions. Now, the way you look for axions is obviously very different from the way you look for things like WIMPs, because they're classical fields, they're oscillating coherently with some local field value, and they're not just sort of recoiling against things in your experiment. And so the search strategies for axions are very distinct from those for other classical dark matter candidates. Now, one of the ways people usually look for axions is via the electromagnetic couplings. So going back to this axion-photon coupling up here, we can write this in terms of the E and B fields as a phi E dot B coupling. And the way this is usually thought about as a way to detect axions is by basically putting a large background B field in some region of space, and either using this to convert, and basically using this coupling to convert axions to photons or vice versa. So for instance, if I put a large background B field, say from some large heavy ion in a plasma, I can convert a plasma photon into an axion, something like in the sun or in a horizontal branch star. I can create axions that way, or I can turn the diagram around and I can use this in an experiment with a large background B field in an experiment to take an incoming axion and convert it into a photon, which I can then detect electromagnetically. And this is the basis for all helioscope and heliscope experiments. Or I can sort of tie these two things together and do a light shining through walls experiment. But I want to ask a sort of different question. I want to use this coupling differently than this sort of canonical way of putting in a large background magnetic field. I would instead ask the question of what happens without a large background B field? If I just have an axion field in the background, how does that modify the propagation of electromagnetic radiation in such a region of space? So this is a well-known story. In order to figure that out, you write down the modified Maxwell's equations, which are shown here at the top of the slide. This is not particularly enlightening in this form. So I can write down the wave equation for A in Lorentz gauge, which again is not particularly enlightening. But I can then specialize to FRW spacetime. So I'm going to have some scale factor A, which depends only on conformal time. I'm going to work in conformal comoving coordinates. What I'm going to do is, by fiat, dictate that I'm going to look for solutions where the axion field varies only as a function of conformal time, and the third spatial coordinate here called z. Z is not the redshift on the slide. Z is the third spatial coordinate. And I'm going to look for solutions to my vector potential which would have the same space-time variation, both in conformal time and the third spatial direction. It turns out that the solutions which are consistent with both this equation of motion and the Lorentz gauge condition are that the zero and three components of A are zero. That's unsurprising. That's the usual way you would have these solutions being written down in Lorentz gauge. And you get two transverse field variables, which I can write in terms of the solicity basis, where I have the one plus or minus I times the two component. And in terms of these variables, this wave equation simplifies down to quite a simple form, where I have the Dillon Boeschen acting on the opposite helicity variables on the right, on the left-hand side here. And on the right-hand side, I get correction terms, which crucially have opposite signs for the left and right-hand helicity modes. Okay, and they depend on gradients of the axion field and gradients of the photon field. Now, again, this is not immediately enlightening. So what I can now do is make one further approximation and say, what happens if I have the axion field evolving in space and time much more slowly than my photon field? So I can then have a separation of scales to perform some sort of approximate perturbative solution, something like a WKB-like solution. And it turns out that if I write down that solution, I get the following. The vector potentials at an observer are the vector potentials at the source with the usual exponential phase evolution I would expect just from the usual wave equation. But there's now a correction term which sits in the exponent here as well. And the correction term has some very interesting features which are kind of important. The first one is it depends on which helicity I'm talking about. It's opposite sign phase shifts for the different helicity modes. It's linearly proportional to the coupling, and it's proportional to the total change of the axion field between when the photon was emitted and when it was absorbed. It doesn't depend on how the axion field evolves between those points in space-time. It only depends on the axion field at emission and the axion field at absorption. And I'll come back to that in a moment to belabor that point even further. Okay, that's a phase shift. What is the observable that comes out of this? Well, it turns out, if you think about this, left and right-handed polarizations are just some superposition of the linear polarizations, or the other way around. I can say linear polarization is just some superposition of left and right-handed polarization with specific phase relationship between those two components. So if I end up introducing a relative phase shift between left and right-handed polarization, I should expect linear polarization to rotate. And it turns out I can actually just do that computation. This basically says that if I compute the electric field in the transverse direction in the ith direction, it gets redshifted from the electric field at the source with a usual exponential phase evolution factors from the wave equation. But I relate the ith component to the jth component of the source via a rotation matrix, an SO2 rotation matrix, where the rotation angle is linearly proportional to the coupling, and again, it's proportional to the total change in axion field between emission and absorption. Now, I want to just make a comment about this, the fact that delta phi appears here only as difference of initial versus final axion field. The way this comes about, and this has sort of been a misleading point in a number of recent studies, is that basically your coupling between the axions and photons is a derivative coupling. So when you integrate a derivative coupling along the line of sight of a photon or line of propagation of a photon, you're integrating a derivative, which by the fundamental theorem of calculus tells you get the difference of the endpoints, right? So that's basically where this is coming from. That's why you end up with this result, which is only proportional to the chain, total change in axion field.
Yeah, so what people missing out?
So people were treating this basically as a random walk process where you have, say, so basically you have, say, multiple different coherence patches.
So you get sort of an enhancement.
Exactly.
Oh, God.
Exactly.
Okay.
So that has been a misunderstanding in some recent works. I mean, this understanding of how this effect works in this sense has actually been understood basically since the very first paper that was written on this in the late 1980s.
This is not a new point. As you said, it's just mathematics. It's not.
Yeah. So this is independent of the details of what happens in the axion field between the two points that I emit and absorb the photon. So that was a lot of math. Let me show you how this works in pictures. So I'm going to assume that there is some source out here on my right-hand side of my slide. It can emit polarization either in the one or two directions, so either vertical or horizontal. And by fiat, I'm going to dictate that there is some axion configuration in space, which is zero outside some imaginary sphere. And inside this imaginary sphere, it has some spatial profile shown here in purple. So it has some spatial variation and a nice smooth profile, so it smoothly joins zero outside the sphere here. And what I'm going to ask is what observers spaced at various points down the z-axis here, I'm going to have photons propagating down the z-axis, I'm going to ask what observers at various points along the z-axis would observe if they had these polarizations being fired toward them. So that's shown by these series of vectors on the z-axis here. So you can see that as I begin to enter the sphere, my axes begin to oscillate, so my polarization begins to oscillate back and forth. The size of the oscillation is given by the local size of the axion field. So you can see you get a much larger oscillation near the origin here where the axion field is largest, much smaller oscillation down here at the entering point where the axion field is smaller. And the sense of rotation is given by the local sign of the axion field, right? So positive axion field gives you a clockwise rotation, a negative axion field gives you a counterclockwise rotation. So an observer sitting at the origin would basically see this incoming polarization rotate in a clockwise direction. But again, crucially, an observer sitting back outside the other side of the sphere where you back to where the axion field is zero sees no net rotation from the initial incident polarization. Okay. So how do you go ahead and study this effect? Well, there have been a very large number of papers written on the subject for about the last 30 years. There are about sort of order 100 papers. And I apologize that you maybe can't read all of this writing. Basically, the fundamental things you require are a polarized source and sufficient axion phase evolution over the light travel time of your experiment to actually get a sufficient rotation to actually be able to resolve. Now, there's sort of two ways you can think about that. You can either go to much heavier axions, which oscillate much faster, and you can make very precise phase measurements, which means interferometry, essentially. So if you go to heavier axion masses and you make very precise phase measurements, you can think about trying to detect this phase shift interferometrically in a lab. And this has been a paper that was written by Walter Rocco and Anson Hook. And there've been a number of follow-up papers, which I apologize again, you can't read here, which have studied this in a laboratory setting. But in order to address the sort of very lightest mass range, the 10 to the negative 22 eV axions, you really need to go either astrophysical or cosmological, because the oscillation timescales associated with the 10 to the negative 22 eV axion are sort of year-long timescales. For 10 to the negative 18 eV axion, it's a couple of hours. But still, the light travel times associated with those get you a good fraction across the galaxy at minimum. Sorry, across the solar system at minimum. So you won't be able to pick up sufficient phase evolution in a laboratory-based experiment to actually resolve this rotation effect. So you need some very distant polarized source which has a very long lever arm, essentially, that it can use to rotate the polarization over some very long evolution period. So you can either go astrophysical and look for various polarized sources, which are either pulsars, AGNs, protoplanetary disks. There have been a number of studies recently on this topic astrophysically. Or you can go for the other obvious one, which is a cosmological polarized source, which is the CMB. And again, this is not a new idea per se, but most of the existing studies for this effect have looked at axions which are much lighter masses than the dark matter region. So these are like 10 to negative 32 EV axions, where you're either forming dark energy or some quintessence field or something which looks like dark energy at earlier times and becomes like dark matter-like at later times. And the phenomenology just turns out to be very different between that case and the case where the axion field is oscillating with a period which is like a year, which is cosmologically fast but slow for laboratory searches. So when we thought about this time variation, what we basically discovered that there are new effects which had not previously been understood for fuzzy dark matter axions acting on the CMB via this rotation effect. I just want to point out here that there are also gravitational effects of axions on CMB and SHP observables. These have been considered before in some detail. They're complementary to our searches. They're looking just at the, basically the modification of cosmology as a result of having axions. They don't arise from this axion-photon coupling, and also they typically only kick in at much lighter masses than the ones I'm interested in this talk. Right, so in order to understand both what people have done previously for the CMB and why we get different results, I need to just briefly remind you about how CMB polarization comes about. So CMB polarization comes about via Thomson scattering of photons or free electrons near the era of decoupling. So if I have an electron sitting here, shown by this purple dot, and it's surrounded by a local temperature quadrupole anisotropy, which means that I see hot regions above and below the electron and cold regions to either side here, that electron is going to re-radiate polarized light. And the reason for that is that if I send a photon in from the hot region toward this electron, it can oscillate either left-right or in and out of the plane of the board. Those are the two polarization states I can decompose the photon into. But only the radiation, photon mode which is oscillating left-right will be able to drive an electron oscillation which will actually re-radiate towards me sitting out here in the audience. The oscillation which goes in and out of the plane of the board, you're going to be looking down the dipole axis at that, you're going to see no re-radiation on that, from that motion. So you'll see from the hot region a side-to-side oscillation of your electron, which will re-radiate light that's horizontally polarized. Similarly, from the cold region, I'm going to see only re-radiation from this electron, which is vertically polarized. But there are more photons coming from a hot region than from a cold region, so I'm going to see a net polarization, which is essentially joining the cold region to the cold region. So I see a net horizontal polarization, essentially in the horizontal direction on this diagram up top here. On the sky, what this looks like, if I have a cold region surrounded by a hot region surrounded by a cold region, I see this sort of porcupine-like pattern. Or if I have the opposite sign of the temperature modulation, I see this sort of circular polarization, but it's not a swirling pattern. So these are known as E-modes, and they're the kinds of CMB polarization that are induced by temperature fluctuations. Now people have, for all the previous studies that have looked at this rotation effect for the CMB, have basically looked for a static rotation of E-modes to B-modes. This is known as DC cosmic birefringence. And the way this works is if I just direct your attention to these pictures of the E-mode polarization, if I just rotate every polarization around its sort of axis by the same amount, you can see I convert an E-mode into a B-mode. So this basically correlates your E-mode, B-mode signals on the sky, and you can then go and look for cross-correlations between E and B or between T and B in your CMB searches. Provided, of course, that you're talking about axions here which evolve maybe in order one amount between decoupling and today. So they're very slowly oscillating axions in that case. Then these searches are the ones that are applicable, and this has been a well-understood story for quite a while now. This is sort of a standard search that CMB collaborations do. The analysis, or the effect we've discovered, though, is that once you take into account the fact that the axion field is oscillating much more rapidly, this no longer becomes the appropriate way to do the search. You don't just get a static rotation of E-modes into B-modes, you get something more complicated. And I'm going to spend basically the rest of the talk trying to explain to you what it is that you would actually see if looking at a fuzzy dark matter axion or an even faster oscillating axion, because the static E-mode to B-mode rotation search is not the appropriate one to do in this case. Before I get there, though, I need to just remind you, so two more facts about the CMB, when it's produced, and a terminology people use to talk about the CMBs. The first one is when it's produced. This is obviously during decoupling. So your polarization is imprinted on the sky around some range of redshifts near decoupling, which is canonically mentioned to be, you know, 1,100 in redshift. But it turns out that the probability of emitting photon around the range of decoupling is actually sort of non-trivial. So what I mean by that is that I can write down what's called the visibility function, which encodes probability density function we're saying what the, sorry, let me start that sentence again. It's the probability density function which tells you the likelihood at which a photon which is absorbed today was last scattered off an electron at redshift z. So this function is basically telling you when the photons you're seeing today were emitted as a function of redshift. And you can see it's sharply peaked here at 1,100, but it has a fairly wide fourth and half maximum. It goes between, say, 1,000 and 1,200. This is like delta z over z of about 0.2. In real cosmic time variables, this is like 10 to the 5 years of duration of decoupling. It's a fairly long period of time. It's not very fast. And this will be a really important point for one of the observational effects that we see for the CMB. Now, once you have this busy function and you know what your temperature quadrupole anisotropy is, which is this variable delta T2 down here, you can just work out the polarization observable that you'd see at any direction on the sky by just integrating the visibility function against the polarization source, essentially. So this is some detailed equation which tells you how this works, but basically what you're doing is you have some source for polarization, you have some weighting function that tells you when the polarization is created, and you just integrate those things against each other to actually get the signal that you would actually see on the sky today. Or in pictures, I have, and again, I apologize, this didn't come up particularly well. I have an observer sitting here at eta naught, looking back along some line of sight. There should be some shaded region here in purple, which is representing the surface of last scattering. And basically, all the photons that arrive at the same time eta naught here have to be averaged over this range of redshifts, essentially, that, where the photon can be emitted. And I have an observer at a slightly later time. They're seeing photons emitted from a slightly different distance, but the same sort of time slices. And you've got to average over all these photons to see what you would actually see for the CMB polarization here today. Okay, so that's when the CMB polarization is imprinted. And just one last sort of technical point before I get to talking about our new effects is I need to just remind you about how Stokes parameters work, because this is the way people usually talk about CMB polarization. So these are essentially four parameters you can use to characterize the radiation, any radiation field. They are I for intensity, which is kind of obvious, V for elliptical polarization, which will always be zero for the CMB, so I can ignore it and everything that follows. And then you'll get Stokes Q and Stokes U parameters. These characterize linear polarization of the CMB on two 45-degree offset axes. So if I have some fixed set of special axes, x, y, and z, and I look out in some direction, n hat, shown here in this red vector, onto the sky, and then I pick coordinates on my sky that are basically the theta hat and phi hat unit vectors to be sort of defining my local set of coordinates for that point on the sky, then if I just stare out, you know, along that n hat direction, I would see this picture here. If my n hat vector points away from me, I get the theta hat and phi hat unit vectors describing my axes. The Stokes Q and Stokes U parameters work in the following way. Polarization, which is vertical on this diagram, would be positive Q and U equals zero. Polarization, which is horizontal, is negative Q and U equals zero. Polarization on this 45-degree line is positive U and Q equals zero. And polarization on this 45-degree line is negative U and Q equals zero. So that's positive Q, negative Q, positive U, negative U. Now, you'll realize that Q and U both change sign twice going around the circle. So these things are basically spin two variables. If I rotate the set of axes by an amount C, my Q and U parameters transform in this way with this 2ixc exponential phase factor here. That'll be kind of important to pull out results which are similar to the ones I've already shown you in a moment. Okay, so that's just a technical reminder of how you can talk about the CMB in terms of Stokes parameters. Now I'm actually going to get into talking about what our effects are. But to get there, I'm going to basically build up the sort of the level of complexity quite slowly, going through three toy models, which will be increasingly realistic and getting towards something which looks like the CMB in my last toy model. So the first toy model I'm going to use to just show you one of the effects is I'm going to assume that I'm just in Minkowski spacetime. I'm going to forget about the expanding universe at the moment. And I'm also going to assume that I can forget about the smearing of the source that I just told you about, the fact that the visibility function has some finite thickness. I'm going to replace the visibility function by a delta function, just basically saying the CMB was emitted at one time in the past, T primed. I will additionally assume that the axion field is homogeneous in the sense that it has the same amplitude everywhere in space. Again, this is an approximation for this toy model. And the only variation from point to point in space is essentially the local phase of the axion field. And what I'm going to assume is that my axion field at the observer has some phase alpha, the axion field at the emitter has some different phase beta, and because here's my absorber over here, my emitter is down here, these are separated both by many coherence lengths and coherence times. I'm going to assume that alpha and beta differ by something which is like an order pi angle in general. So these are basically not correlated oscillations between the emitter and the absorber. But I will make the following assumption, that if I measure the CMB now or some short number of axion periods later, so maybe I make a measurement now and I make a measurement 6 months from now, then the axion field between these two points in time is going to basically have the same phase alpha because you're within a coherence time for the axion field, at least down at these masses. The coherence time is much longer than 6 months. And moreover, the points in space where these photons were emitted from on the CMB are going to end up being closer together than a coherence length. And so the two different values of beta that I would pick up for, you know, photons being absorbed at T or at T plus delta T are going to be the same values of beta. So basically, beta doesn't depend on when I'm observing these photons either. So the only thing here essentially that ends up depending on time is this piece of the local axion field. Are there any questions about that? Okay. So what I can now do is I can write down what my Tor model is actually going to be. So my Tor model is going to be the following. I'm going to assume I have a photon gun at the source, which can fire n photons polarized along the e-hat 1 direction. So again, I have my theta hat and phi hat unit vectors on some direction n hat on the sky. I'm defining some axes e1 and e2. And I'm going to assume my source can emit n photons along a direction e1 and m photons along a direction e2. So if I measured the polarization of the source, I would see n photons along this direction, m photons along this direction. But of course, there's a rotation of polarization that occurs between source and observer. And so the incoming radiation I'm actually going to see from this point in the sky is not going to be this. It's going to be a rotated version of that, which is shown here. So I can now go ahead and compute the Stokes Q and Stokes U parameters, which characterize this incoming radiation field, the rotated one. The intensity is proportional to the number of photons I receive. That's unsurprising. There's no circular polarization. And my Q and U parameters for this specific point on the sky have this form here. So let me unpack this expression a little bit. Firstly, it's proportional to a fundamental or an intrinsic polarization asymmetry at the source. If the number of photons along the two different directions is the same, I see no asymmetry, I see no polarization. So I need to have different numbers of photons along the one and two directions at the source in order to pick up a net linear polarization at the observer. It's proportional to the intensity, because this is just the fraction of the intensity that's actually polarized. So that's unsurprising. There's a factor here which is psi, this angle here, which is this angle of rotation between my theta hat and e hat 1 axes, which again is just some choice of how I've chosen to pick my local coordinates on the sky. So this is nothing fundamental. This is just some artifact of how I've chosen to orient my coordinates on the sky. But now you'll see this. There's an additional phase shift here as well, which comes in from the axion rotation effect. So this is the same axion photon coupling times delta phi, where delta phi is the difference of the axion field between the field at the absorber and the field at the emitter. Now, the only thing here that depends on the axion is this last term. So these first few terms would be essentially what I would observe for the Stokes Q and Stokes U parameters in the absence of an axion rotation effect. So I can write down the Stokes Q and Stokes U parameters at the point on the sky, given by n hat, as being what I would observe in the absence of an axion effect, multiplied by an exponential phase evolution, which tells me how these Stokes Q and U parameters rotate into each other. So this is nothing more than a restatement of what I told you earlier, that polarization rotates, and the rotation angle is g phi over 2 times delta phi. Okay, so far I've done nothing particularly interesting here. I've just rewritten what I've told you before in terms of Stokes Q and U parameters instead of electric fields. But now, let's imagine that I do the following. I'm going to stare at one point on the sky, and I'm going to make an observation at time t1, and I'm going to make another observation at time t2, which is going to be a few axion periods later, or maybe a fraction of an axion period later. And I want to compare the Stokes Q and U parameters I'm going to measure at those two different times. Now, the CMB source is not evolving on year-long timescales, at least not in any significant way. So the only thing that's going to be the going to make a difference between the Stokes Q and U parameters I measure at these two different times for the same point on the sky is the difference in the axion phase evolution between those two points in time. Now, each of these delta phi 1s and delta phi 2s is the difference between, you know, axion field at the absorber and axion field at the source. But I've already told you that T prime is fixed, beta is not varying in time as I move my observer slightly forward and back in time, because you're still within the same axion coherence patch in the early universe when you're emitting the photons. Alpha is not changing in time. So the only thing here that really depends on time is this piece of the phase of the local axion field. So the difference between delta phi 1 and delta phi 2 is just basically given by the evolution of the local axion field as a function of time. So if I pin T1 and just monitor the photon polarization at one specific point on the sky as a function of time after that, what I'm going to see is the Stokes Q and U parameters rotating back and forth into each other. Or said differently, this is a real on-the-sky AC oscillation of the CMB polarization at every point on the sky in phase and phase coherent across the entire sky. Phi naught here in this toy model is just assumed to be homogeneous throughout the entire universe. I will get back to a modification of that actually tells you what it really should be in a real model when I get to model 3. Okay, so this is as far as we are aware, no one has ever pointed this effect out before with the CMB, that there is an actual AC oscillation at the axion period of all CMB polarization vectors on the sky. And the period is, say, about a month for 10 to the negative 21 EV axion. So this is something which should actually be amenable to experimental detection, because, you know, CMB experiments integrate for year-long timescales. It does, indeed. And I'll show you in a moment where what you can basically constrain with existing data. Exactly. So there have been a number of papers, which again, you can't read at the bottom of the slide here, which have talked about this AC effect in the context of astrophysical sources, but as far as we know, no one has pointed this out for the CMB before. Okay, that was one new effect. I promised you two. In order to get the second one, I need to put back a bit more complexity in my model. So I need to now assume that my visibility function is no longer a delta function. So I'm still going to assume I'm in Minkowski space. I'm still going to assume here the axion field is homogeneous throughout the entire universe up to phase changes from point to point. But now I'm going to put back the fact that my visibility function should be some range of redshifts, essentially, around decoupling. And my model now will be that my n plus m photons that were previously emitted all at time t primed are now going to be emitted in some duration of times delta t primed, and the probability of emitting a photon at any time during this period is going to be weighted by the visibility function. Okay. The crucial point, which distinguishes this from the case that all the previous cases that have studied this axion effect, is that the axion field is oscillating many, many thousands of times during this duration of decoupling. So as I've already told you, this duration of decoupling lasts 10 to the 14 to the 5 years. The axion oscillation period is something like a year at most for 10 to the negative 22 eV axion. So there are 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 axion oscillations during this decoupling duration. So the limit when I have large photons is 6. It turns out I can compute the Stokes Q and U parameters in the following quite simple way. I take my expression that I previously had for the Stokes Q and U parameters, which is basically this exponential piece up top out here, for a single fixed emission time t primed. And I integrate this against the visibility function, which is the probability of emitting a photon at any given time t primed. And I just integrate this over the line of sight, right? It's quite a straightforward thing to do. I'll spare you the math and just show you what the final result is and what it is in pictures. So the final result is the following. The observable Stokes Q and U parameters that I would observe at any one point on the sky at any one fixed observation time are related to the Stokes Q and U parameters at that same point on the sky that I would observe in the absence of an axion effect. Here, again, is my exponential phase evolution, which is telling me that there is this AC oscillation on the sky, which is governed by the size of the local axion field and the coupling, and at a period equal to the axion mass. So this is the effect I've already told you about, is this exponential piece here. But now you see this additional factor in front here, which is a Bessel function of the first kind at zeroth order, which I've shown here plotted as a function of argument. It goes from 1 and oscillates back and forth, but has a decaying envelope. Crucially, if this argument is small, this function is like 1 minus x squared over 4. So this is something which is slightly smaller than 1. So what this is telling you is somehow the averaging over my axion phases during emission of the photons has somehow reduced the amplitude of the polarization that I would expect to receive at the observer today.
It should depend on the mass, right? Does it decouple if you take the mass to infinity?
Provided you fix the density,
yes. Ignore the density for a second. Let's say fixed density, and I want to see how that prefactor goes as the mass goes to infinity.
Yes, it will decouple.
Ah, okay.
Because if you have a fixed density, your g essentially final proportional to 1 over the mass then,
okay,
right?
Okay, so you see it explicitly.
Yes.
So there is a factor of the mass somewhere. I mean, you have the density in there, I understand, because you fixed it to be the dark matter. So.
Yes, exactly.
So
exactly. Yeah, and you'll see that
overall, it behaves as you would expect it to.
Yes, and you'll see that explicitly in the limits I'll show you in a moment, that the limits get weaker at higher masses.
Okay.
So I want to explain the sort of physical origin of this washout effect, because it's a little bit confusing when you first see it. Suppose my CMB is telling me that at one point on the sky, all my photons should come out polarized vertically. That's not the way CMB actually works, but just for argument's sake, let me assume that my CMB is telling me that all the photons in one direction of the sky are supposed to be vertically polarized. Now, at one fixed observation time, there is one fixed local axion field, but the photons that I'm receiving from the early universe have been emitted at any one of, say, 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 different axion periods during decoupling, because there are many oscillation periods of the axion field during the decoupling epoch. So the change in the axion field between the early universe and today for each incoming photon is essentially just a random sampling of all the possible rotations you could have within the amount of variation the axion field has in the early universe, right? So instead of seeing just one incoming polarization vertically, I'll instead see some sort of fanned out set of polarizations that are coming in at one point in time. And I'm going to integrate across all of these incoming polarizations at the same time in my detector, right? So instead of seeing a net polarization, which is just vertical and of this initial amplitude here, when I average this down, I'm going to end up seeing a polarization which is slightly reduced in amplitude compared to what I would expect, but still pointing in the same direction, because I'm basically averaging the left and right-handed oscillations against each other. And in the limit of large photon statistics, you get no net left-right rotation, but you do get a reduction in amplitude of your polarization with respect to the lambda CDM prediction. So this is the second effect that has not previously been pointed out for these, as a result of this rotation effect, is that you reduce the amplitude of CMB polarization below the lambda CDM expectation. And then, of course, as I've already said, you still see the AC oscillation. So now if you stayed at one point on the sky, you'd see a slightly reduced polarization, but doing this in time, essentially, oscillating back and forth AC at the axion period. Okay.
Can the cyclical or standard model physics create the washout?
As far as I know, no. What it does, what it normally, okay, so yes, it can wash out polarization in the sense that it moves things around in multiples. Basically, you can drop power at small scales and move it to larger scales when you rescatter off the reionized universe. Yeah. But that's an effect which has got an L dependence to it. And I'm going to argue that this is not going to be dependent on L.
I see.
Okay. So I want to make the point again. This washout effect, which is the new effect we're picking up here, only comes about because the axion field is oscillating many, many times during decoupling. And this is what distinguishes it from the previous cases that have been studied in the literature, where you get this net DC rotation between E modes and B modes, because in those cases, the axion oscillation period was much, much longer than the decoupling. It was basically cosmologically long in those cases. So we just get a distinct phenomenology because it's just a physically different case. And it turns out that the static emo to BMO conversion is just not the right way of thinking about doing this analysis for this faster oscillating axion field. Okay, now that I've shown you both effects, I just need to do one last thing, which is basically clean this up and put it in sort of more realistic context, which is something which more closely approximates the CMB, which is my toy model 3, which I'm going to call toy model 3, but is really the CMB. What I do here is I need to just put this back in FRW spacetime, and I need to put in a realistic axion field that actually varies as a function of time in the universe. So once again, I have my observer sitting here at conformal time eta. This is now conformal time and co-moving distance, seeing photons that were emitted over some range of conformal times in the early universe. The rotation effect operates the exact same way in FRW as it does in Minkowski spacetime. There's no change at all between those two setups. And so once again, in the limit of large photon statistics, I get the same expression I had before. For the Q and U parameters I would observe at some point on the sky, I just take the Stokes Q and U parameters I would observe for a single emission time and integrate them against the visibility function to figure out what I would see at any one point in time at the observer. But I also now need to put in here, so the delta phi now put in here, though, has to be the actual delta phi in the universe between the early universe and today, the change. So I need to just briefly remind you what the axion fields are, both in the early universe and today. So the early universe axion field can be written in the following way. You get the axion field at a specific observation emission time and direction of the sky is some amplitude. There's a factor which is redshifting, like 8 to the minus 3 halves, because the whole field is redshifting like 8 to the minus 3, because it's called dark matter. And it can be written with some cosine and oscillation with some offset phase. The amplitude of this axion field is set by requiring that the dark matter density saturates the early universe dark matter density. And if you require this, then it turns out that phi star, this amplitude here, is 10 to the 11 GeV for a 10 to the negative 21 EV axion that saturates the cosmological dark matter abundance. The local axion field can be written sort of similarly, except it's not redshifting anymore. So you just have phi naught, which is some local field amplitude, multiplied by the same sort of cosine oscillation, just with a different phase from before, but the same oscillation period. And once again, I normalize this by requiring that the local axion abundance makes up the entire dark matter abundance. So for 0.3 GeV per cubic centimeter and 10 to the negative 21 EV axion, this says that phi naught needs to be 10 to the 9 GeV, 2 times 10 to the 9 GeV. And the fact that these two things are not wildly different, they're only different by 2 orders of magnitude, is going to be kind of important in a moment. The reason, by the way, this is only different by 2 orders of magnitude is that you're down 9 orders of magnitude from the early universe to the present day average density of the universe, but the galaxy is overdense by 5 orders of magnitude, so you're only down by 4 orders of magnitude in density between the early universe and where we are today in our galaxy. And of course, the density goes like the field squared, so you only get 2 orders of magnitude difference in the field. Okay, so now I put in this early universe axion field, this local axion field into my expression for the Stokes Q and U parameters. I perform the integrals and I get a final result. It turns out, so this is the integral I'm doing. I turn the crank many times and I get a final result now, which should look familiar from the one I've shown you from toy model 2. Observable Stokes Q and U parameters are the unmodified ones with an AC oscillation effect here now explicitly seen to be governed by the local axion field amplitude, phi naught, and the oscillation period being fixed by the axion mass. And there's a washout effect, which is again governed by this Bessel function here, which is now seen explicitly to be governed by the early universe axion field for the washout effect. This is some averaged early universe axion field here, because I've now got to average over, you know, the fact that the axion amplitude is evolving during the decoupling epoch. But for once you've extracted the effect, basically you can make the approximation of the visibility function is now a delta function again, and you can basically just replace this average with the value at the peak of the decoupling with about 20% error. There's no real reason that you need to really go about doing this averaging effect. And you see here there's no net unsuppressed static DC rotation between E modes and B modes, or between Stokes Q and Stokes U. You only see a reduction and an AC oscillation. Okay. Now, as I said, the fact that phi naught and phi star are not dramatically different from each other is kind of important for the following reason. The AC oscillation effect is got an amplitude which is linearly proportional to the coupling times the current local axion field value, which is the smaller of the two amplitudes. The washout effect is proportional to 1 minus J naught, essentially. The amount of polarization you wash out is 1 minus J naught, but that's quadratic in the coupling times the early universe axion field. That's a larger parameter, but this is still a small parameter. G phi is still going to be a small parameter. So this is a larger small parameter squared compared to a smaller small parameter linear, which, if you think about it for a moment, it's not immediately clear to me which of these two effects is actually larger. And it turns out that, roughly speaking, these effects are going to be of comparable size in the region of parameter space that we're going to be interested in for actually constraining or potentially detecting these axions. So I need to really keep both of these effects in mind when I actually think about what the experimental observations are, observables are, which is what I'm now going to do. So I'm going to start off by ignoring the AC oscillation effect, because it's the harder one to think about, and it's the one we actually haven't done the real analysis for, because you need CMP time series data to do that. I'm going to start by focusing on this washout effect, because we can actually set a limit using existing data. So if I ignore the AC effect and ask, what does this washout effect do to my CMB observables? Well, if I just take my Stokes Q new parameters that were predicted from lambda CDM, and I reduce them by this amount governed by the Bessel function, then this doesn't touch the temperature anisotropies. So my TT autocorrelation TT autocorrelation power spectrum is unmodified. My TE cross-correlation power spectrum gets modified by one factor of this reduction, and my EE autocorrelation power spectrum gets modified by two factors. Okay. So this is a specific pattern of reductions for my expectations for the CMB power spectra for my temperature and two polarization power spectra. And this is uniform across all L, because this depends only on an averaging through the surface of last scattering, not on any angular size that you have on the CMB sky. Right? So this should be a uniform reduction of polarizations with a specific pattern over all values of L, with the one exception that at low L, this is not the correct set of expressions, because at low L, the CME gets reprocessed by the reionized universe. So for L less than 20, this is not the correct expression for how our effect works.
That's because you're setting phi zero to be constant across homogeneously across spatial direction, right?
Yeah, because that's true. I mean, like in the early universe, this is 10 to the minus 5 fluctuations.
I mean, especially at that time, it's 10 to the minus 4
Exactly. Fluctuations. So yeah, there'll be some very tiny correction to this, which is an order 10 to the minus 4, but you know, that's a second order effect, which we're not going to care about here. Okay, so I can now go and look for this pattern of reductions. I'm going to start off by doing an approximate analysis, which gets you an answer, and then I'm going to come back and clean up some of the sort of hand waving that occurs in this approximate analysis in a moment. So the approximate analysis is going to be doing the following. I'm only going to consider high L multiples to avoid this problem at low L that you've got to worry about the reionized universe rescattering CMB light. So I'm going to look at all the L's I have available to me above 50, which goes up to 1,996 for the Planck 2018 data. Don't ask me why, that's just the way they cut it off. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to form a likelihood function to test, basically do a one-parameter profile likelihood ratio test, looking for a washout effect, which is governed by size, this parameter R, which is the coupling times early universe axion field, against the null hypothesis that there's no washout effect. Okay. So my likelihood function is going to be given by summing over all three power spectra, the TT, TE and EE power spectra, summing over all L's. And again, I'm ignoring here, this is an approximate analysis, I'm ignoring cross correlations between, you know, spectra and L's, which actually occur when you do a real CMB experiment. But now my likelihood function is going to be formed in the following way. I take actual Planck observed power spectra and actual Planck observed uncertainties in those power spectra, and I try and fit them with the theory prediction, which is whatever I get out of lambda CDM here, but corrected for a reduction effect which depends on which power spectrum I'm looking at. So for the TT power spectrum, this factor is 1. For TE, it's 1 factor of this reduction. For EE, it's 2 factors of this reduction. Okay? I'm also, however, going to allow an additional free parameter in my fit, which is a common amplitude or normalization of all three power spectra together. Because I'm going to make the argument that essentially that's the largest obvious degeneracy within lambda CDM with our effect, that you can just renormalize all three power spectra together. And the reason for that is the following. Suppose I have three data points, the TT, TE, and EE power spectra here with their uncertainty error bars here. And suppose my CMB fitted these three data points perfectly. This is at 1L, right? Now, if I fix the amplitude of the power spectrum at the CMB best fit, and then just did this reduction where I keep TT the same, reduce TE by, say, 1 sigma and EE by 2 sigma, the delta chi-square I get out of that fit is like 5 for that one point. If instead I renormalize the amplitude of all the spectra so that TE fits well, TT gets pulled up by 1 sigma, EE gets pulled down by 1 sigma, this delta chi-square is only 2 for that one point. So you can sort of, this is a very heuristic, very approximate way of thinking about this, but you can basically see from this that I can partially compensate this reduction effect by renormalizing the size of my spectra. I get a smaller delta chi-square than I would expect if I don't allow this parameter to float. So in order to do an honest analysis, I need to allow this parameter to flow to my fits. This is where I said I'm going to wave my hands around in the air. This is obviously extremely approximate and ad hoc. I'll come back on 2 or 3 slides from now and show you how this works in the actual CMB analysis when you really profile over all the CMB parameters. But just to get a flavor of where we're going for the moment.
I think I've asked you this before. So the amplitude of the action, the plot of G phi gamma and phi star that you constrain here implies that when you go back to the early universe, that was a huge factor in front of FF2.
Yes.
So why doesn't that mess up a lot of stuff? I mean, the effective G phi gamma is the effective suppression scale is much...
Here it's fine. I mean, it's a factor of maybe 100 less than the larger than the amplitude field. So it's small, but in the early universe, when the thing started oscillating, this was orders of magnitude larger than 1. So it's a huge prefactor.
Oh, no, sorry. G phi star in the early universe is not always magnitude larger than 1.
Yes, it is when the action starts oscillating. Because if you wanted phi star to be dark matter, that means you extrapolate back what phi star is. I can tell you, for example, for a mass of 10 to the minus 21, that's close to the gut scale. Here, your effective coupling, if the amplitude of the CMB is 10 to the 11 GeV, your effective coupling is 10 to the 13. So that means already that's a factor of 1,000 in front of FF2.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that is true. I don't necessarily have a particularly good answer to this question. I view this as basically just a constraint on the parameter space. This is obviously a different question you can ask about.
Yeah, but if you're constrained to be in a factor G phi gamma gamma to be order 1 when the action field started oscillating, then that's, it's not a viable parameter space. That's why I'm wondering, you're sensitive to huge effective photon couplings.
Yeah, I think that probably is true.
That's just a matter of where the constraint lies now, right?
Yeah, this is about, yeah, exactly. So this is where the constraints can get you. Whether or not this is a really viable parameter space that you can have the dark matter axion sitting here, that's a slightly different question, right?
No, but it's true, right? But that, sorry, but if it's not viable parameter space, then is this interesting to do? So, it may be fine for some reason, but this is something to consider.
Sure.
Because that's a huge prefactor.
No, I do agree with you on that, yeah.
This is in the actual electrodynamics. This is something that started oscillating at when the universe was a year old.
No, I'm just trying to think what could go wrong.
Instabilities in the NEM equations, and that's something that happens past BBN.
In the what equation?
In the ENM. ENM. Yeah. I don't know what can go wrong. I've
There is, I mean, this has never worked out, but...
No, I think I agree with you. There's probably a check to be made there about, you know,
yeah,
what the other constraints are on this.
I mean, I've thought in principle some sort of plasma instability, but plasma mass at the time is very large. But it sounds like such a huge coupling. It's like a factor of 1,000 in your Lagrangian, effectively. So it sounds, yeah, it sounds ginormous.
Yeah, yeah. Let me just make the comment that I think, yeah, there are other things that need to be checked here. This is where you can get with this effect. If it turns out that's not viable parameter space, then we can obviously those checks can obviously be done.
Yeah, look, I'm just saying this is something to be checked. I don't know if it's bad or
sure.
not, right?
Yeah, no, I think I would agree with you that a check needs to be
it's
done as well.
It just sounds so funny.
Right. Okay, so just to get back to where I was, so I'm doing this likelihood analysis where I'm fitting my observed Planck power spectra with this theory prediction, which is modified from lambda CDM by this Reed's reduction factors, but allowing a common amplitude A to float in this fit. So I do a profile likelihood ratio test, which means I profile over the best fit point for A, and I can set a 95% confidence limit on the reduction of the power in the CMB, which is 5 parts per mil. So on a coupling parameter space, mass coupling parameter space, this looks like the following. So on the vertical axis here, I'm showing the axion coupling and inverse GEV, axion photon coupling, and the mass of the axion on the horizontal axis between 10 to the negative 23 and 10 to the negative 18 EV. So before I talk about our constraint, which is this green box, let me just say briefly that cast constraints kick in just below 10 to the minus 10. This is helioscope constraints on the axion. Small scale structure constraints from dwarf galactic scale structure and galactic scale structure kick in below 10 to the negative 22 EV. There's some sort of fuzzy region down here where these constraints become more and more problematic. There is a claimed exclusion from Lyman alpha, which sits here at 10 to the negative 21 EV, but there is some disagreement in the literature about what the status of that limit is because this depends on modeling of small scale structure in the early universe. This is really hard to figure out what the limit here actually is. And there's also a claimed constraint for supernova 1987A, which is basically coming from axions emitted in the supernova get converted to gamma rays. But that depends both on, you know, the source properties and on electromagnetic fields in order to set this limit. So again, I'm just going to present this here for transparency, that there is a claimed limit here, but I'll leave it up to you to decide what you think about the status of that limit.
Is there a white dwarf cooling belt here at Breslau Mass?
I don't believe it's as strong as cast.
Ah, okay.
Okay. I think, yeah, these are definitely the strongest bounds down at these low masses. Okay, so on the basis of this approximate analysis I've just shown you, yep.
What is the region where your G5 gamma times phi star is logging?
It's anything above this line here.
This line, eh?
That line.
G gamma gamma. Yeah, but this is at the time of the CMB. If you take it back in the early universe,
yeah.
This entire parameter space.
Why is it like straight?
No, it's not straight.
I'm pointing to the value of G.
Yeah, so yeah. For this is what he's talking, he's taking a fixed value of the coupling, and then, so the value...
So yeah, it should be a, you know, 10 to the negative 21, it's a line here, right?
Yeah, it's
like,
yeah, right?
Yeah, it's a line here.
Yeah, there's some line here where it's below there, right? If you want it to be G phi gamma always less than 1, it's well below this line.
I'm asking a different question. Like, do your analysis still hold, G times phi is bigger than 1?
It holds in the sense that that's going to cause an order 1 rotation of the CMB, and there's going to be no polarization at all, right? So the WKB analysis doesn't depend on G phi being small. It depends only on the ratio of scale variation of the axion field to scale of variation of the photon. That's the small parameter you're expanding in. The WKB solution actually holds for G phi order 1.
Okay. I see.
So yeah, it still works. Okay, so on the basis of the approximate analysis I've just shown you, we rule out this parameter space here shown in shaded in green. So you can see at the lowest axion masses down here, we're doing about 3 orders of magnitude better than the best cast constraints at these lowest masses. And this is with existing data, right? This is an actual experimental exclusion with existing Planck data. This is not a projection. Okay, but of course you can definitely object to what I've just told you because I waved my hands in the air about how I actually did that analysis. I told you there was one direction in CMB parameter space which was most degenerate with our effect. I haven't necessarily convinced you that there isn't some combination of CMB parameters that could be degenerate with our effect exactly. And I need to really do the sort of fitting process a bit more carefully. So what we did then is we went ahead and did a rigorous analysis where we basically profiled over the full lambda CDM parameter set. So the full 6 parameters that specify your lambda CDM cosmology. So we, in order to do this evaluation, we use CAM to evaluate what the power spectra would be for any given set of input parameters. and Monte Carlo techniques to sample this likelihood. So again, we do a profile likelihood ratio test with one change though from the previous analysis. I need to now include the low L data in my likelihood because there is a degeneracy between log alpha S and 2 tau. So that's these two parameters here in my CMB fits because at large L, the CMB power spectra only depend on one combination of those parameters. So I need to include the low L data to break that degeneracy. But I do that in an approximate way. Basically, what I do is smoothly turn our effect off at low L. Because as I've already told you, the low L CMB and isotropies have been rescattered off the reionized universe. And so the way our effect is going to work for those low L multiples is going to be just different from the CMB. You're not going to be averaging over as long a period of time. So, or as large optical thickness. So we're basically just going to make the approximation you turn this effect off at low L. I can say two things about this. Firstly, it's approximate. Secondly, most of the statistical power is not coming from low L, so this shouldn't really make that much difference to the end result you get anyway. And if you want to do this properly, you have to run Boltzmann codes. Now, the problem with doing Boltzmann codes here is that the entirety of the effect is coming from the oscillation of the axion field. And this axion field oscillates 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 times during decoupling, which means you actually have to track those oscillations all the way through decoupling. The usual way that CMB codes run is not tracking 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 oscillations during decoupling. In fact, all the studies that looked at gravitational effects of axions have essentially defined some approximate axion fluid by averaging over the oscillations. So this becomes extremely computationally challenging and extremely hard to do computationally when you've got to average over these many thousands of oscillations of the axion field. So this is approximate in that sense, but it should still give you a really good approximation to what the actual constraint would be. So having done all of this, I get a more rigorous 95% confidence bound now, which is dramatically different from the one I showed you previously. It's now 6 parts per mil, not 5 parts per mil. So it's 9% weaker than the previous limit. And I've now definitively answered the question that whether or not there are degeneracies with lambda CDM, there aren't. And I can now show you again what this looks like in coupling mass parameter space. It's the same line I showed you previously. It's moved up by about the thickness of this line that delineates the region here. So this is essentially the same constraint that I showed you previously. And I can do a projection for where you can go in the future with this. So that was with existing Planck data, which is already in the can. What I can now do is say, let me go back to the approximate analysis technique, because I know it works to within about 10%, and assume that I can measure all three power spectra out of the cosmic variance, to cosmic variance limits out to L equals 3000, and I'm going to assume Planck sky coverage. That might be a bit aggressive for CMB stage 4, but I want to see sort of ultimate reach here. I can then go ahead and compute the median projected 95% confidence bound, and that turns out to be 0.8 parts per mole, so that's about a factor of 7 better than the current constraints. But then you don't get any further with this effect. So in terms of coupling, because this effect is quadratic in the coupling, you only do an effect of root 7 better on the coupling. And so you end up getting this line here, which is this dotted line showing the cosmic variance limitation for the search. So this effect was not previously known. We've now put a limit, but you basically can't do much better than the current limit with this effect. So that's a little bit depressing, but you would like to try and do better than that. But now this is where the AC effect comes into its own. So I've ignored the AC effect for the purposes of this search. What if I put the AC effect back now? So I want to just remind you about the AC effect. It's distinct from any cosmological signature because it's a real on-the-sky point-by-point oscillation of the local polarization angle. It has an AC period of something like a few years to a few hours. It's set by the axion mass. It's a single frequency oscillation, so it's monochromatic. It's phase coherent over extremely long periods of time. Even for the highest oscillation periods here of a few hours, the coherence time is like 10 to the 3 years. So this is way longer than any experimental lifetime. And it's also in phase across the entire sky. You would see the same oscillation in phase across the entire sky because it depends only on the local axion field, not on the direction I'm pointing my telescope. So this has extremely significant discovery potential because there are highly non-trivial cross-checks you can perform on any signal that you would see in any one experiment because you can go to a different experiment that has different systematics. You can look at a different patch of the sky, which has got different foregrounds, and you can look at different observation times and you can still see the signal being phase coherent at those later times. So there are a highly set of highly non-trivial cross-checks you can do if you were to see a signature here.
Can I ask you something?
Yep.
So as time passes, you observe a different patch of the sky, which is a new CMB, and the spatial variations of the phase over these different spheres are negligible because they are smaller than the coherence length. So here, basically, you're assuming...
That's irrelevant, right? Because you're averaging over all the axion phases at emission, so you average over the phase anyway, and the local phase is still the same.
No, yeah, you average over that phase, so it's true.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Unfortunately, we can't actually do the analysis for the AC effect ourselves because it requires CMB time series data to do this. Because these oscillation periods are, you know, years to hours, which means that in the course of, you know, Planck's measurements lasted 4 years, they revisit every point on the sky every 6 months or so. That means that they're actually essentially averaging over this oscillation effect in their data if it were to exist. So we would actually need to have the CMP time series data. That doesn't exist as a publicly available data set. So we're currently in discussions with a number of our CMP experimental colleagues on BICEP and elsewhere. And they seem to be quite interested in performing this analysis, both from the point of view of actually doing this searching for the axion, and also because it does kind of double duty for them to, as a non-trivial cross-check on their systematics of the experiment. They can look for AC oscillations in their systematics. So unfortunately, I can't show you like a really rigorous analysis of the AC effect, but I can give you some estimates or projections for how well this should be able to do. So what I'm going to do is sort of reason by analogy. There was a recent Planck result which looked at the all-sky DC rotation. So I want to remind you, this is not RFX. This is looking for the static E-mode to B-mode oscillation. What they found was a rotation angle, depending on which analysis technique they use, which is essentially zero within uncertainties. And they uncertainties are basically much larger in systematics than statistical uncertainties. The reason is these systematic uncertainties are from DC calibration offsets from Planck, because Planck actually finds it quite hard to calibrate their field, their detector in the far field, basically to figure out whether or not their two polarimeters are at 90 degrees to each other or not. So the best they can do is like a half a degree, I think it's about 0.3 degrees now, offset between those perpendicular axes. So that's their limiting systematic effect. However, that limiting systematic effect is a purely DC calibration offset, right? This is not an AC power spectral density of noise. This is the DC power spectral. This is the sort of zero frequency bin in the power spectral density of the noise. So this systematic uncertainty is not the relevant one for looking for an AC signal, right? Essentially, this is just saying the noise power spectral density at zero frequency is not the noise power spectral density at finite frequency. So there will be some systematic effect that needs to be understood at the axion oscillation period, but it's not this systematic uncertainty. So I'm going to base my estimate off the statistical uncertainty here, because that should give you some estimate of the power of the search. But there's one slightly complicating factor about this. The DC search is doing an analysis using E-mode and B-mode cross-correlation power, sorry, TB and EB cross-correlations. And that's because its power spectra are necessarily cosmic variance limited. So there's necessarily cosmic variance sort of complicated up in this whole story for those all-sky analyses. On the other hand, our effect is not very limited by cosmic variance at all, because all I'm saying is, find a region of the sky that has high polarization and measure it as a function of time. That doesn't depend on cosmic variance at all. So I'm going to argue that the AC search, both because it doesn't depend on cosmic variance and because there's a specific period to the signal, should be able to do at least as well as the statistical power on the DC search. That's obviously a claim, which I'm going to just put out there, using as a benchmark for where you might be able to go. The systematics and calibration obviously need to be understood more carefully for an actual experiment, but absent detailed information from inside experimental collaborations, that's very hard to estimate on the basis of public data. So what I'm basically going to do is show you two benchmark points. And just for apples-to-apples comparison, I'm going to present them as 95% confidence exclusion bounds. The first benchmark point is saying, suppose I could resolve an oscillation at 0.1 degrees in amplitude. And the second benchmark is saying, let me be optimistic about where I can go in future and do a factor of 10 better in the size of the rotation I can resolve. The ultimate reach here is sort of an unknown, because it's not even clear to us necessarily that canonical CMV experiments are really the best way of going about doing this, because what you want to do here is build something which is extremely stable to measure one point on the sky really, really well, rather than do some scan across the sky. Obviously, you can't anchor a telescope on the ground to point only one direction on the sky at all times, but there are potential interesting things you can think about here in terms of maybe there's just a different search strategy you need to perform to optimize for this effect compared to ordinary CMV analyses. Sort of an ongoing piece of work we have related to this. So with these two benchmarks, I can now show you where they lie on the mass coupling parameter plane. So these two red lines now give the two benchmark parameters. So at 0.1 degrees, anything above this red dot dashed line would be discoverable or excludable at 95% confidence from this AC search. So you can see this is just slightly inside the existing bound from the Planck washout search. This doesn't do quite as well as the washout analysis right now, but this AC search is not cosmic variance limited, and it's also linear in the size of the coupling. So if I do a factor of 10 better on measuring the angle, I do a factor of 10 better on the coupling. So you can see if I did 0.01 degrees, I can actually blow past this cosmic variance limitation on the from the washout effect. So the future reach for this AC effect is much rosier than the future reach for the DC for the washout effect. Just as one cute point, that point in parameter space up top here, which is a 10^-22 eV sitting at the Kars bound, was previously not excluded. At that point in this mass parameter space, you would find a rotation on the sky of 1 radian. So this is an enormous rotation back and forth in the sky. So that's a deeply excluded region of parameter space. All right, So with that, I want to just finally conclude. What we've done in this work is re-examine the effect of the axion photon coupling on CMB polarization when the axion masses in the fuzzy dark matter range. We found two new phenomena that have been overlooked as a result of this photon polarization rotation effect. The first is a polarization washout, which is a reduction in power, polarization power on all pristine CMB scales. It comes from averaging over the axion phase at emission of the photons. And the limits at the lowest masses here are some orders of magnitude better than the current existing bounds. Ultimately, though, however, the search is cosmic variance limited, and we're almost at the cosmic variance limits already. The AC oscillation, by contrast, is a point-by-point on-the-sky oscillation of the CMB polarization angle at the axion period, phase coherent over time, in phase across the entire sky. To actually set limits on this effect requires dedicated analyses that require internal CMB collaboration data, which is sort of an ongoing discussion we're having at the moment. I've been able to give you estimates or projections that show you that this is probably at least as good, if not better, than the washout effect using current or near-future data. It's not cosmic variance limited, and the discovery potential is significant because there are significant non-trivial cross-checks you can do if you do see a positive signal in any one experiment. So we think this is an exciting new way to think about trying to either constrain or detect fuzzy axion dark matter. Thanks.
Thanks, Michael. Other questions?
Coming back to Nina's question, so if you have in front of you in the early universe, you have a large time-dependent function.
Yeah.
So this is parametric resonance. The time dependence will be dictated by the axion mass. You could create a lot of electromagnetic fields.
This is what I think. Well, I kind of checked this. That was my worry too. I don't know when I was thinking about this, but I think you're shut off by the plasma mass. Mm-hmm. So the plasma mass is pretty high then. But it's still a huge coupling, so I don't know what happened. So I haven't.
It's a very interesting physics.
Yeah.
It may not be bad. Maybe interesting.
No, but it takes away all the energy power of the axion, so that means all this parameter space cannot be the dark matter, because you just transfer the axion energies. The axion energy, which is at the time where you're radiation dominated, so even if you take away
all the axion, will stop being that matter.
Yeah, yeah. It also becomes non-relativistic. Sort of becomes relativistic, right? Because you backtrack on the axion condensate as well.
So then it just takes away. One has to rethink completely everything.
So it's not that matter anymore.
Yeah, so that parametric resonance story is a very interesting one, but I'm not entirely sure what happens in...
It's not clear what happens. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
yeah.
Well, it's a huge coupling. I mean.
Yeah.
You don't expect running of the coupling itself, also if the field is so large.
This is an anomaly coefficient. There's non-normalization theorems for that. I mean, but there could be other things like nonlinear effects. I mean, you could have higher order terms that become important because. Yeah, so let me tell you the following. Four axion interaction through a photon loop. I mean, now this is a huge fact.
It's not necessarily suppressed.
It's not necessarily separate. I don't know how it will go.
Yeah.
Even at CMB, right? Like for some of the reds,
where
G5 becomes one.
Okay. That is sitting in this sort of deeply excluded regime, right?
Yeah,
so that's most likely going to be excluded by maybe other things.
If you take the supernova bound.
No, I'm just saying it might be a bet, right? Why is it?
I mean, I would be surprised if there's not some large effect that you're talking about here, which isn't constrained by something else. Then in that case, right? So at the limitation of this bounded region, it's a small product.
Would affect any other.
I mean, this line basically, if you're 10 to the minus 11, if I estimate properly, if you're at 10 to the minus 11 for a 10 to the minus 21, when things started oscillating, you are way down at around, this is at least three orders of magnitude down, if you want to have it order one at the time where the action starts oscillating.
Yeah.
Which
right.
is still a bit problematic, by
right, right, right.
because in principle, that anomaly coefficient comes with alpha over 4 pi, which is a 10 to the minus 4. So you need the factor factor of 1,000 boost relative to the natural value. So in principle, it's at least a factor of 1,000,000 compared to the expected value. But
yeah, I agree. There's a theory issue that needs to be addressed there, I think. Right?
Yeah, I mean the thing is that if you look at the experiment, the only thing that I can think of is this fact that coefficient is ginormous, and all of these masses started oscillating after PBN. That's the other thing, because this is like 1,000 seconds, right? So it goes down a few hours, so this is 1,000 seconds there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this is yeah.
Yeah, that's enough. This is
out here,
BBN
actually.
Is
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's after BBN that they started oscillating.
So it can really affect things.
Yeah, but.
Yeah, I think there's certainly some interesting stuff to think about there.
Yeah.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, it is a general concern about how dark matter in this high coupling regime.
Exactly. No,
yeah.
It's a very general thing.
Yeah.
I completely.
Yeah.
You mean if the coupling is.
This regional parameter space, as in general, this problem, it's not related just to one.
It's only
because
I mean, there's some diagonal
there
line
some
on this.
Line here.
Yeah.
So there is some so-called, let's call it naturalist line here, which lies about three orders of magnitude below where you're bound.
Sure. But I mean, I would just make the point that, like, you know, this 0.01 degree AC oscillation effect, we actually really don't know where the ultimate reach for that goes, right? I mean, like, you could do a couple of orders of magnitude better than that.
But the point is that it's good to know where,
sure.
If there is vibe.
No, I agree.
Yep.
Whether people
should
spend money on it.
Well, then the nice thing about this is that you'd get this for free, right? The Planck limit is for free, because that data already exists.
No, that's true.
Yeah. Well, the AC also. Fair enough. But I mean, there will be at least to some level. This will be data which would already exist when you do CME stage four, right? Simon's observatory, I think, is interesting in thinking about how large this effect could be for them. And sure, I mean, it's definitely if you were to design a dedicated experiment looking for the AC effect, that's the question.
Or test the same.
That's the question. But you would certainly get this analysis for free out of CME stage four to some level.
Questions? No? Okay, then let's thank Michael again.
Thank you.